Hi, I'm your host Gigi, and welcome back to Noir True Crime Files. To close out Pride Month, I wanted to cover the senseless murder of a young Black lesbian named Sakia Gunn. I used a lot of sources for this episode, but the majority of my research came from a documentary called Dreams Deferred, the Sakia Gunn Film Project, a Democracy Now! Interview, articles from the New Jersey Star-Ledger, the New York Times, Gay City News, and Wikipedia. All sources will be posted in the show notes. It was 3:30 a.m. on May 11th, 2003, when five teenage girls were making their way back home to Newark, New Jersey from New York City. Among those girls was 15-year-old Sakia Gunn. As the girls were waiting for the number one bus on the corner of Broad and Market Street, two African-American men pulled up next to them in a white station wagon. The men started catcalling the girls, asking them to come closer. At first, the girls just said no and ignored them. The men weren't satisfied with the girls' lack of interest, so they got out of the car. As they got closer, the men were making even more lewd comments. This interaction shouldn't have even gotten to this point. No, leave me alone. I'm not interested. That should have been enough. Unfortunately, things only escalated further. The girls began to argue with their street harassers. They told them that they were all lesbians and weren't interested. Then, according to court documents, one of the men grabbed a girl and placed her in a chokehold. Sakia and another friend named Valencia Bailey began hitting the man, trying to get him off of their friend. The man then reached under his shirt, pulled out a knife, and stabbed Sakia in the chest. The two men then ran back to the station wagon and sped away. Valencia ran down the street to a car that was stopped at a red light and banged on the driver's side's window. A startled man rolled down his window, and Valencia begged him to drive her and the girls to the hospital. Thankfully, the man agreed. On the way to University Hospital, the girls were noticing that Sakia was bleeding profusely. By the time they made it to the ER, Sakia took her last breath in Valencia's arms. Sakia Latonna Gunn was born on May 26, 1987. At the time of her death, Sakia lived with her mother Latonna Gunn and her grandmother Thelma Gunn in Vailsburg, New Jersey. A sophomore at Westside High School, Sakia played on the girls' basketball team and was a straight-A student. She was well-liked and, quote, never gave her family any trouble. According to a blog called Republic of Tea, Sakia came out to her mother when she was 11 years old. Everyone in her life loved and accepted Sakia, so her sexuality wasn't really an issue. As she got older, Sakia began identifying as an AG butch lesbian and comfortably wore looser fitting men's clothing. AG, which means aggressive girl, and butch are both older terms to describe masculine presenting women, butch more so than AG. These days, when specifically describing Black masculine presenting lesbians, the current term to use would be stud. The night Sakia was murdered, she and her friends had been hanging out in Greenwich Village. The Chelsea Pier section of the village was a popular area for LGBT youth of color specifically because it was free and there was always groups of other teens from all over the city in one place. The girls had taken the PATH train back to Newark, and it was at the corner of Marketplace and Broad Street where they were confronted by the two men. Although there was a police booth nearby, there wasn't anyone occupying it at the time Sakia was stabbed. As soon as the news spread about Sakia's death, her friends and teens from other neighboring high schools set up a shrine at the bus stop where she was killed. There were dozens of flowers, candles, teddy bears, and even a basketball signed by her friends that thankfully covered the blood that had stained the pavement. The Wednesday following Sakia's murder, there was a candlelit vigil held in her memory. On May 12th, the day after Sakia's murder, Newark PD held a press conference. Spokesperson Lieutenant Todd McClendon announced that Sakia's murder was going to be handled as a biased crime and that there was a warrant out for the suspect who had murdered her. Based on the witness statements they had gathered, police were able to get a description of the suspects, what car they were in, and witnesses also confirmed that the girls had told their attacker that they were gay before Sakia was stabbed. Valencia had also been able to get the license plate of the station wagon and gave it to police. On May 13th, the getaway car was found in East Orange, New Jersey. However, I wasn't able to find out under what circumstances the car was found. On May 15th, 29-year-old Richard McCullough turned himself in to the Essex County Prosecutor's Office. McCullough, who was accompanied by his lawyer, was then arrested and charged with murder, weapons possession, and bias intimidation. Alan Pierce, the other man with McCullough the night of the murder, was brought in for questioning but was never charged in connection to Sakia's murder. As McCullough was turning himself in, a crowd of over 300 people, including Sakia's friends, family, schoolmates, and representatives from local LGBT organizations, peacefully marched to City Hall chanting, "No justice, no peace." Although Mayor Sharp James never came outside to address the crowd, Sakia's mother Latana, her uncle Anthony Hall, a few of her friends, Newark City Councilmember Hector Corchado, and Reverend Jacqueline Holland took turns addressing the crowd. The following day, Sakia's funeral was held at Perry's Funeral Home in Newark, and she was laid to rest at Fairmount Cemetery. There were about 2,500 people in attendance, including Mayor Sharp. Sharp spoke with Latana after Sakia's service and pledged that an LGBT community center would be established for the youth in Newark. However, 3 months after Sakia's murder, no meeting was ever scheduled to discuss plans for the community center. Till this day, that community center has never been built. In the months following Sakia's murder, there wasn't much news coverage, especially on the national level, about her case. Professor Kim Pearson of the College of New Jersey did a comparison analysis of the number of news reports written 2 months after Sakia's murder and compared them to the number of articles written 2 months after the murder of Matthew Shepard. Shepard's murder made national news and magazine covers after he was killed in a hate crime in 1998. Pearson found that after Sakia died, that there was only 11 articles written about her 2 months after, while Matthew Shepard had 507 stories written about him 2 months after he was killed. Sakia and Matthew's race, gender, and socioeconomic status definitely played into why news coverage for their murders differs so greatly. You have to take into account that Shepard was a white, gay man and had the stereotypical all-American boy look. He also came from what was considered a good family. Sakia was black, and to some, upon first glance, she could have been mistaken for a young boy. She was not from a, quote, good family, as her mother had been a teen when she was born, and her grandmother was her legal guardian at the time of her death. Sakia was also from a working class area that was predominantly black and Latino. Not only was Sakia largely ignored in general by society, but she was ignored by her own community because of where she was from and how she looked on top of her sexual orientation. Despite that, it should not have deterred media outlets from telling her story. Clarence Patton of the NYC Gay and Lesbian Anti-Violence Project put it simply, saying, quote, "You don't have to be black. You don't have to be young. You don't have to be queer. The fact that a young woman who was waiting for the bus and was murdered should be enough to outrage anyone," end quote. Students at Westside were also dealing with a lack of support from school officials after Sakia's death. In an interview with Democracy Now! 2 months after the murder, Sakia's girlfriend, Jamon Marsh, described how students were told by administration that they could not have a memorial service for Sakia and that the school also would not be offering any grief counseling to the students. Jamon claims that Valencia was told directly that she would have to seek out those services on her own. Jamon firmly believes the school did this because of Sakia's sexuality. The year prior, another student at Westside passed away, and Jamon said that during that time, students were offered grief counseling and there was a memorial held on school grounds. Westside's principal, Ferdinand Williams, also allegedly made a distasteful comment about Sakia's death, saying, quote, "When you choose a certain lifestyle, you must pay a certain consequence," end quote. When Williams was questioned about these allegations, he denied them all and also refused to speak with the press regarding Sakia's case. A year later, Williams did give a statement explaining that he didn't publicly speak on Sakia's murder because it would have been too difficult for the school to deal with at the time. Quote, "I didn't want to open some of the wounds the students are trying to heal," end quote. In an effort to instill tolerance in the schools for LGBT youth and to provide sensitivity training, Westside held a no-name calling day for the first anniversary of Sakia's murder. There isn't much personal information available online about Richard McCullough, but what I did find was that he was raised by his lesbian grandmother, and his only other criminal offense was a charge for marijuana possession. After turning himself in, McCullough was taken to the Essex County Detention Center and held on a $500,000 bail. At that point, McCullough was facing up to 30 years in prison and initially pleaded not guilty to all of his charges. Almost 2 years later, however, McCullough was able to accept a plea deal that dropped his murder charge and reduced his potential jail time. Under the terms of the deal, McCullough pleaded guilty to aggravated manslaughter, aggravated assault, and bias intimidation. This also meant that there wouldn't be a trial and that McCullough would be sentenced immediately. On the day of sentencing, April 21st, 2005, Sakia's family and friends, as well as McCullough's family, arrived at the Essex County Courthouse and took their seats on opposite sides of the aisle. There weren't any local or national media outlets in the courtroom. However, Charles Bennett Brack, the director of Dream Deferred, the Sakia Gunn film project, was there filming. When he addressed the crowd, McCullough's lawyer, John McMahon, tried to vouch for his client's character by saying he had, quote, led a law-abiding life for a substantial period of time, and that McCullough had never given him, co-counsel, or the court any issues. Sakia's family members were able to give victim impact statements, but it was Valencia's statement that honestly brought me to tears. Throughout the sentencing portion of the documentary, you can see Valencia in her seat, shaking and crying while she's being comforted by her mother and her friend. When Valencia's turn came to give her statement, she held a photo of Sakia tight to her chest and talked about how McCullough had a choice to leave them alone that night. They were young girls. He was a grown man. He had no business talking to them in the first place. Valencia cried as she explained how she did everything she could to save Sakia, knowing that Sakia's life was slipping away as she was laying in her arms. Valencia said that she and Sakia were inseparable and that they'd been making plans to go shopping for Mother's Day and how they were also planning to celebrate their birthdays together. But now they wouldn't be able to do any of those things. McCullough would eventually be able to go home one day, but Sakia would never be able to see any of her friends or family. Valencia just walked back to her seat, hung her head, and continued to cry. It was really heartbreaking. Two of McCullough's family members gave statements during sentencing stating that McCullough was a good person and was just at the wrong place at the wrong time. They didn't believe that he should receive a harsh sentence and that he'd made a mistake. As he was filming, Brack observed the tension between the Gunn and McCullough families. They traded glares at each other across the aisle, and the McCullough family appeared unsympathetic and didn't really seem to get it, according to Brack. When McCullough was given the opportunity to speak, he addressed Sakia's family by apologizing to them and took accountability for his actions. He also apologized to his own family for disappointing them. Finally, Judge Paul Vichdes sentenced McCullough to 20 years in prison with the possibility of parole after 85% of his sentence had been served, meaning he'd be eligible after 17 years. McCullough was then sent to Mid State Correctional Facility in Fort Dix, New Jersey. On May 13, 2020, Richard McCullough was released from prison. Some black men and their extreme hatred towards masculine black lesbians is nothing new. You could literally open up Twitter and there's a cisgendered black man making a random, unnecessary, vile, quote-unquote joke about a stud right now. I started this podcast with a story somewhat similar to Sakia's when I covered the murders of Brittany Cosby and Crystal Jackson. Brittany's father, Larry Cosby, murdered the couple because he disagreed with their love, and he was also jealous because he felt that they were living better than him, even though they all lived in the same home. Some black men feel a sense of ownership over women and masculinity. Seeing black women who are not only masculine presenting, but proud and comfortable in their skin can be seen as a threat. And then the unwarranted antagonization starts. You just want to be a man. You could never do the things I do. But that's the thing. Lesbians, especially masculine ones, don't want to be men. The Richard McCulloughs of the world think their penises, or simply speaking a few words to a gay woman, will suddenly, and I'm using bunny ears here, turn them back right as if there's something wrong with them. This is part of the delusion that homophobic men tell themselves. For Sakia and her friends to not only fight back and reject him, McCullough probably felt he had no other choice but to assert his dominance further by killing Sakia. It's a shame that he got off light, and since that time, more black lesbians, whether they are mass presenting or not, have been harmed simply for existing. McCullough could have been used as an example, like Matthew Shepard's murderers, had he been given a harsher sentence. Darnell L. Moore stated in a 2017 Logo article that cisgendered men, quote, have to do the hard and critical work of self-reflection that we can unlearn the many ways we have been taught to harm. As much as we are conditioned to look around and point fingers at the forces that harm us, we too must examine the extent to which those same forces have taken residence within each of us, end quote. I think that some blame can be attributed to the LGBT community as a whole. When you look at the media representation, it's majority white. The main news outlets for the community have slowly started to integrate more minorities into their branding and programming, but that doesn't mean the issues of racism don't still exist. There was only one white journalist on the front lines reporting Sakia's story, and that was Mike Meenan of Gay City News. Meenan said himself that he believes Sakia's story barely got coverage because of her race and socioeconomic status. Sakia's death led to the creation of the Newark Pride Alliance, the Mayor's Advisory Commission on LGBTQ Concerns, and Essex County's Executive LGBTQ Advisory Board. However, according to Gary Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the African American Office of Gay Concerns, not much has been done to support Newark's LGBT community since Sakia's death. There is a lack of support and cooperation from city officials, and activities that had previously been approved would suddenly be canceled. On the 10th anniversary of Sakia's death, an event held in her honor was barely covered by local news media, and only one New Jersey congressman, Frank Pallone, was in attendance. In comparison to the event held on the first anniversary of Sakia's murder, many people were in attendance, including local media, as well as former New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker, who was a mayoral candidate at the time, and current New Jersey Mayor Ras Baraka, who was also running for office at the time. In a 2019 article for the New Jersey Star-Ledger, Wright does credit the Heatrick Martin Institute for their after-school LGBT youth program, but feels that it simply isn't enough, especially if the city found enough money in their budget to fund a new hockey arena. Several lives in the LGBT community have been lost in the last few weeks, either due to unnecessary violence by police or by other civilians filled with hate. Beyond the month of Pride, we should be showing support to all Black LGBTQIA plus brothers, sisters, and non-binary. I know when I say Black Lives Matter, I'm including every single Black person, which is why stories like Sakia's, Crystal and Brittany, Tony McDade, Nina Pop, Rhea Milton, Dominique Remy Fells, TT Gully, and countless others need to be told. I'll be linking episodes from other Black podcasters who have covered some of these stories, and I do hope that you not only support their shows, but also support any GoFundMes or organizations that support the Black LGBT community. Before I end the show, I want to spotlight a queer Black-owned business. Houseplant Junkie is an online plant shop that was created for Black plant lovers. The owner, Shay, actually grew up hating plants, but when her girlfriend brought home a pothos one day, she instantly fell in love. After an unpleasant visit to Homestead Gardens, where she wasn't helped and was also followed around the store, Shay decided then that she would open up her own shop. You can